We'll come to that shortly, but that's very observant of you. So, Robin, if we go to the next one, please.
What is it? Makes you wonder if PTSD.
Sorry, I'll just talk a bit more about the re-experiencing symptoms because I think this is really helpful to understand what is happening for people. Excuse me, I just have some water. So the re-experiencing symptom cluster for PTSD is having recurrent intrusive distressing memories, that is, images or thoughts or perceptions that they come in uninvited. It's not that the person kind of has gone to think about that particular experience in the past necessarily, but they just come in uninvited, and that is partly to do with way the memory has been recorded or written in the brain in the first place under conditions of high threat and high arousal. That mean that this particular memory of this trauma has not been kind of integrated in the usual way. We'll talk a bit more about that in the treatment section. The re-experiencing symptoms can include recurrent distressing dreams, so nightmares related to the event. People will often, during normal wakings during the night, will wake from nightmares, and that makes it very difficult for them to get back to sleep. After, often they're waking up covered in sweat because they've been dreaming about this situation. And so it's really very difficult for sleep for people with PTSD. The dissociative reactions can happen, as I mentioned before, flashbacks in which the person may actually feel as if that traumatic event can be ha is happening again. So being lost in the memory, it is the memory kind of replaying itself, but to such a vivid kind of degree that people are kind of lost in that experience. And these re-experiencing symptoms cause intense psychological distress for the person. And they have the same physiological reactivity that I talked about before in terms of the fight flight reactions that are innate to the body. They have those same reactions to reminders of the trauma. So those cues that kind of link to that traumatic experience. Thank you, Robin. We can go to the next one. So the next cluster of symptoms for people with PTSD is the avoidance cluster. So, which naturally enough, people that have had traumatic experience, their tendency is to want to avoid any external reminders of that situation. That includes people, places, activities, or objects or situations of anything that's connected to that trauma. They also try to avoid their own memories and thoughts and feelings that are closely associated with the traumatic event. But what we know, which sort of seems like a sensible thing to do, but actually what we know is that avoidance is one of the primary maintaining factors for PTSD. So it is in the efforts to avoid anything connected with the trauma that, people tend to have these re-experiencing symptoms and these memories just popping back into their minds uninvited. It's a bit like when you say to people, okay, now I want you to not think of pink elephants. No pink elephants. What happens? You think of pink elephants. It's the thing that you do the very thing that you're trying to avoid. Thanks, Robin. We'll go to the next one. The next cluster of symptoms is around the hyperarousal symptoms. So this is, as I've said, this is when people are at this very heightened level of readiness and responsiveness, just being ready for any threat. And I'm sure that when we get to the discussion, that the hyperarousal symptoms will be a very significant feature for all of you as carers. And this can look like hypervigilance, so being very ready for threat. It includes an exaggerated startle response. So when you have, you know, something, a door slams or whatever, people with PTSD will jump out of their chair because they've just got that readiness to for threat, that any startle just really gives them a jolt. They have problems with concentration, you know, because they're, and that's partly what my PhD research was on, looking at using functional imaging and looking at, you know, the difficulties people with PTSD have just with processing everyday mutual information. You know, it seems to take a lot more cortical area for them to manage information in the context of all of the rest of the things that they're managing. Like I said, there's the hyperarousal symptoms include sleep disturbance. So, you know, significant difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, as I said, with the nightmares that often happen. And can include irritability or outbursts of anger. So people when they're in that kind of hypervigilant, hyper-aroused state have a short wick. You know, they're very easily irritated and, you know, don't cope so well and can get angry easily, or can engage in reckless or self-destructive behaviour as well. Thanks, Robin. Okay, can we just go back one? Sorry. So this cluster of symptoms is about how PTSD changes how you think about yourself and the world and your mood. So people often will have persistent and exaggerated negative beliefs about themselves as being worthless or unlovable. They might have these negative beliefs about others, that other people are unsafe, people can't be trusted. They'll have those views about the world, you know, that the world is unsafe. So the trauma exposure has kind of impacted how they view themselves and other people in the world. They'll also have persistent kind of distorted thoughts about the causes or consequences of the trauma that often lead the person to blame themselves, or sometimes others, but most often they blame themselves and then get stuck in the thinking, if only I had done something differently, this wouldn't have happened, and those sorts of magical thinking. They suffer with persistent negative emotional states, with the difficult emotions. So strong feelings of fear, horror, anger, and then guilt and shame. So these are the more difficult emotions to experience and manage, and that they often persist. And in managing all of that and suffering from those things, they often have significantly diminished interest in participating in activities, and then can feel detached and estranged from others. They can tend to get very kind of insular in managing their own internal world and not have the ability to experience much positive emotion, including happiness or satisfaction or having loving feelings, because they're most often plagued with feelings of fear and horror and guilt and shame. So you can see then how, you know, debilitating PTSD as a diagnosis is. Thanks, Robin. We'll go to the next one now. So as Michael has identified in that first list, there's some overlap with complex PTSD and BPD, and I'll explain that. So in the diagnostic system, the International Classification for Diseases, the 11th edition, they have added a diagnostic category for complex PTSD. And by complex PTSD, it we mean that things have happened during development, and that could be bullying, as we've talked about, or it could be neglect or emotional abuse or sexual abuse. And so those things have happened during development. And so complex PTSD, the complicating factor, I guess, is that those things happen during development, and that then impacts how that person grows up and how they see the world and whether they can trust others and so on. So to get a diagnosis of complex PTSD, you must meet all the diagnostic requirements for PTSD, including having a criterion A stressor and the, you know, the re-experiencing symptoms. So you don't have to have all of these particular categories. Usually it's having two of those things that I've listed. So re-experiencing symptoms, avoidance symptoms, hyperarousal symptoms, and then the you know, negative alterations of mood. So you've got to have all of those. And then in addition, complex PTSD is characterized by severe and persistent problems in regulating emotions, so in affect regulation, as well as beliefs about oneself as being diminished, defeated, or worthless, and accompanied by feelings of shame, guilt, or failure, as well as difficulties in sustaining relationships and feeling close to others. Often this is around, you know, the ability to trust others. And for this diagnosis, you need for these symptoms to cause significant impairment in a number of areas, so personal, family, social, educational, occupational, functioning. So as Michael correctly pointed out, there is some overlap between a diagnosis of complex PTSD and BPD in terms of difficulties with relationships and difficulties with regulating anger and difficulties with dissociation. But they're not, the overlap is not complete. So there's some overlap, and this is where it's a broader kind of discussion about what we call in psychology as discriminant validity. So that is the ability for those two diagnoses to discriminate particular things from each other. But Michael's rightly identified there's a lot of overlap. So there's has been a lot of debate in the literature about the discriminant validity between those two things. My view is that they're not actually the same thing. BPD and complex PTSD are not the same thing, but many people with BPD have trauma histories and complex trauma histories, which I'll talk about in this slide. So as I said, many people with BPD do have a history of trauma exposure, often across their lifespan, and high rates of trauma have been reported in patients with BPD, which range from about 70 to 80% of people that have a trauma history. That includes a criterion A stressor. So not all people with not all people that are diagnosed with BPD report trauma, nor do all people who experience trauma go on to develop BPD. And we talked about that in terms of PTSD, but it also applies in this conceptualization here. So there's overlap, but they're not the same thing. In terms of what we want to understand about the comorbidity, if we think that they are actually describing two different things or two related things, let's say, we know that the incidence of PTSD with BPD, when it co-occurs, and we call that when it's comorbid with BPD, is a range between 47 to 56%. So let's say around about 50% of BPD, people with BPD also meet criteria for a diagnosis of PTSD on top of that. And I've listed the other other anxiety disorders and substance use and eating disorders here in order to provide some context for that comorbid presentation. So mood disorders, so depression is very high, as well as anxiety disorders and substance use disorders. And then the eating disorders that we often also see comorbidly with BPD. Robin, would you go to the next slide, please? This is a very busy slide where I'll try to sort of make it, digestible. This bears on the question about does PTSD affect the body that was, asked of me. And there is, probably lots of slides that I could put in here to address the question of PTSD affecting the body. But the answer is yes, it does. We can detect a range of different changes that happen with PTSD. And these include neuroendocrine abnormalities. So, and that includes the stress hormones that are released in response to trauma, including cortisol, which is and adrenaline, which are primary stress hormones. So the regulation of those stress hormones, which is carried out by a group of brain structures and the adrenal glands on top of the kidneys that regulate that function, changes in PTSD. There are neurotransmitter abnormalities, in particular noradrenaline, which is one of the neurotransmitters that has been implicated repeatedly in some of the symptoms of PTSD. For example, with autonomic, like the hyperarousal that we talked about, insomnia, increased startle response, are all characteristic of increased noradrenergic function, so noradrenaline. In terms of neurobiological abnormality, so in the brain, we know that there are a number of changes that can be detected associated with PTSD, including possibly reduced hippocampal volume, so the size of the hippocampus, which is a structure that is exquisitely responsible for memory consolidation, is thought to be smaller in PTSD, and it's also a brain area that is very sensitive to the effects of cortisol, and cortisol is toxic to the hippocampus, actually. And so one of the hypotheses around that is that perhaps the cortisol upregulation that later gets down-regulated has kind of damaged the hippocampal function. There are reductions in neuronal density in the hippocampus in PTSD. There are changes in resting blood flow in the brain, and also functional activity of the brain, which I mentioned before, even in trying to process trauma-neutral information. Robin, would you be able to go back to that slide that I spoke about medication? Thank you. My apologies, that was out of order. This next section, I would like to talk about treatments. And I thought we'll talk about medications quickly, and we'll talk about psychological treatments. There is some evidence for modest improvement on four medications for PTSD. So they are now included in some of the treatment guidelines as recommendations. But it's, good to know that the effect sizes for for these medications are modest. But these are the ones to try in a first line sort of treatment if you're wanting to look at medication. So the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors group, so sertraline, which is branded as Zoloft, fluoxetine, also called Prozac, and paroxetine are the ones that have some evidence for treatment of PTSD. The other medication is a serotonin noradrenaline reuptake inhibitor, and that is venlafaxine, also called Effexor. So those are the four ones that have some evidence to have some benefit. But it is probably helpful to say that, like with many of these medications, residual PTSD symptoms following treatment is the rule rather than the exception. So in all likelihood, the medications might help with being able to sleep a bit better, or you know, slightly improving your mood, but they're not actually going to treat the symptoms of PTSD and make that go away.
Are there any new medications on the horizon, Kat?
There are some medications that have been used off-label and are starting to gain some evidence for their efficacy. So I've mentioned here prazosin, which is actually a bit like a heart medication, a bit like a blood pressure medication. It actually blocks one of the receptors in your blood vessels, and that's involved in kind of those hyperarousal symptoms. And so reducing your sort of blood pressure and arousal. And some people have some benefit from that. There is another medication that is used sometimes, topiramate, which is actually an anticonvulsant medication, but some people have had some benefit with that in terms of, you know, managing nightmares and flashbacks and so on. But these are, when I say they're off-label uses, it's the drug has been kind of accidentally found to help with these things, rather than that's not what it's been designed for. So people have sort of found that there's a benefit to that. But often what happens is that they're not on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme for PTSD. And so people, if they're trying them, would have to pay more, because they're not, you know, on, as I said, not on the PBS for PTSD. I guess the thing to take away is medication has a limited role, and that's, I guess, why I've sort of put it up first, and then we can talk about psychological treatments. So Robin, if you would go back down to the slide that says psychological therapy. Oh, actually, sorry, I'll talk a bit about it. Thank you. I'll talk a bit about early intervention first, because I think this is really something that we've discovered in the last probably 10 years or so. Around 9/11, there was lots and lots of research that was done around what kinds of things are helpful to people in the immediate period of time following traumatic exposure. And have looked at, you might have heard the term critical incident stress debriefing or psychological debriefing. And what we know is that actually after a significant trauma, there is a normal trajectory of recovery. That many people, after something like a Criterion A stressor happens in your life, that it is normal to have images and memories and to be popping into your mind uninvited. And this will happen to everyone after, you know, after a traumatic experience. And it's also normal to know that will resolve itself over time. And if you allow, you know, 3 to 6 months for those symptoms to reduce, over time they will resolve. So there is a normal trajectory of recovery after trauma. And that when you go in too early and wanting to do sort of work around psychological debriefing that can actually interfere with the normal recovery process. And often those clients that got that kind of debriefing fared worse than those that were left to recover normally. So they had significantly higher rates of PTSD. There is some evidence that CBT-focused interventions for those people that are showing acute stress disorder symptoms can be helpful. So if those re-experiencing symptoms and the intrusions are so severe that you can't function, then there is some evidence that, getting to see a psychologist in the earlier stages could be helpful. If you go to the next slide, Robin, that would be terrific. So broadly, there are psychological therapies are first-line treatments for PTSD. There are a number of different ones, which I'll talk about a little bit about each of them to try and answer the questions about, what kinds of things are you actually doing in these treatments. So prolonged exposure is the one treatment that's probably been researched the most and was developed by a North American psychologist called Edna Foa, and I'll tell you a bit more about that. Cognitive processing therapy is another psychological treatment for PTSD that's got very good evidence. Trauma-focused CBT, which I'll talk a bit about what that looks like as well. Then a treatment called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. So abbreviated, we call it EMDR. And I'll talk a bit about what that is. And then I'll talk about sort of a newer treatment that, a newer treatment that has been accumulating evidence for it, called the prolonged exposure protocol for PTSD. So we call it DBT-PE. Robin, if you go to the next one. Just before we talk about the specific treatments, I thought I might talk to you about what some of the models that are underlying some of these treatments. And I think this one by Ayles and Clark, which they're from the University College of London, have proposed. So their model is that persistent PTSD, when it stays around, is associated with appraisals, our sense of kind of viewing the world and judging the world, that create a sense of current threat. So for a traumatized person, they can't relax. They don't feel safe in the world at all. And they feel like any moment, something bad could happen to them again. So that sense of current threat. There's also negative appraisals of their symptoms. So the fact that they've got these symptoms tells them that I'm damaged forever. I'm never going to recover from this. I'm never going to be free of trauma. Then we conceptualize, this idea that PTSD is actually a problem of memory, and that under the conditions of very high arousal in amongst that trauma, that the memory of that experience itself was not actually consolidated in a way that puts it into the past. And that is a key function of the hippocampus in order to kind of timestamp memories so that the brain knows that they're in the past. And this idea that kind of the re-experiencing symptomatology is like the brain's way of trying to heal itself, as much as that person is suffering from it. It is trying to kind of integrate those experiences which are kind of outside of the realm of normal experience. And then we know that there are some behavioral changes and strategies that people with PTSD do that can maintain the problem. So we've talked quite a bit about avoidance and how that seems like a natural response, but in fact, avoidance is one of the things that kind of keeps that process happening. Rumination. So, you know, getting preoccupied with thoughts of if only, what if, why me, and also revenge ideation. People can get very stuck in thinking about revenge. Then they can also get into habits of safety behaviors that can be really impairing, like sometimes won't even leave the house, for example, which prevents them from, you know, ever being able to disconfirm the beliefs that I'm always, you know, I'm always under threat, the world is not safe, etc. Robin, so if you'd go to the next one. So in those kinds of cognitive models, there are three targets for treatment. So what you're trying to do is help that person to elaborate that memory and integrate that memory into the context of their individual experience, so that it can be appropriately sort of put into the past. You're also trying to address the problematic appraisals that maintain that sense of current threat, of currently being under threat, and also some of those, you know, behavioural or cognitive strategies that people are engaging when in because they think it sort of helps but actually maintain the problem. So you go to the next one. Thanks, Robin. So in terms of what is involved, you know, in these particular treatments, the prolonged exposure treatment, as I said, is an exposure-based treatment. So what that means is that you're actually asking people to relive that traumatic experience in therapy. And initially, you're talking about it in the past tense with somebody with their eyes open in as much detail as they feel comfortable with. And then you would later do that reliving experience in the present tense with all the thoughts, emotions, and body sensations that you remembered. And then you would get the person to take that account, and you would get them to re-listen to that over and over again in between sessions. And the idea is that in going over the traumatic experience in this particular treatment is that it does the memory consolidation work, and also because the person has been avoiding any thoughts or reminders of the trauma, essentially you get them to habituate to retelling over and over and over again that traumatic experience.
Can I ask a question? Why are psychologists reluctant to do PTSD treatment? They sort of put it off and say we have to deal with the BPD first. But what if the PTSD is more prominent? Or
it's a very good question, Michael, and people differ on their views on that. I guess what you can see from this is that having to retell your traumatic story that you've tried to avoid over and over and over again in as much detail as you can is very difficult. And you are going to bring up all of those very difficult emotions, all of the very difficult you know, memories of that experience, and people need to be able to tolerate doing that without resorting to some of the maladaptive ways that, or, you know, some of the ways they may have historically managed those things. So we know that, you know, for people with BPD and PTSD, often they will, you know, harm themselves, or there might be suicidal behaviour in response to those things. So I'll talk about this a bit more when I get to the PE, DBT-PE part, but I think it's really about being cautious that the person can actually tolerate doing that work, because it's not easy work. But there are differing views around this, which we can talk a bit more as well at the end. There are the problems with prolonged exposure are that, as you can see from that summary of what you might be doing, is like, and as I said, it's very difficult. So there's quite a high dropout rate from that treatment. And as you, and I think clinicians are also a bit scared of doing this treatment because it feels like you could destabilize the person, and then what if they can't cope? Yeah. So I think there's a, you know, a bit of caution around that. If we go to the next slide, Robin. CPT, so cognitive processing therapy, is another evidence-based treatment for PTSD. And all of these treatments, much like the treatments for BPD, they're about all about as effective as each other. So there's no one particular treatment that is leaps and bounds ahead of the others in terms of effectiveness. So CPT, developed in the early 90s, is like starts with a 12-session model, sometimes up to 20 sessions, usually twice a week. This is a manualized treatment where PTSD is conceptualized as a disorder of non-recovery, that people get stuck at points. Now, we talked about the normal trajectory of recovery, but that people kind of get stuck at certain points along the way, usually around how they're thinking and interpreting the event that maintains their distress, typically self-blame and guilt and shame, those difficult emotions that we talked about. So this treatment focuses on doing, you know, cognitive therapy on the stuck points, helping people to challenge their thinking around things. And they do daily sort of worksheets. There is a variation of this particular therapy that does involve the person writing a trauma narrative. So they will write a trauma narrative and go through it with you. I think it's about session 2 or 3, and then again at the end. But there's more recent sort of work that says it doesn't, the addition of that trauma narrative doesn't necessarily change the outcome. It might for those people that are very dissociative, so they seem to need to do the writing part of the treatment. And in the last 5 sessions, there are several themes that are addressed explicitly, and that includes safety, you know, because people with PTSD don't feel safe anywhere, issues with trust, issues with power and control, and self-esteem and intimacy. So some people sort of consider that CPT feels a bit gentler than doing prolonged exposure work, and it, you know, there's the variant where you actually don't have to go through over and over again the you know, the narrative of the traumatic experience. Robin, if you could go forward. Thank you. EMDR is another treatment that is recommended by all of the guidelines for treatment of PTSD as an evidence-based treatment. I think what is clear is that we don't really understand perhaps how it works. And so what you do is the client is asked to focus on imagery of the traumatic experience, including, you know, their thoughts and their body sensations. But in this treatment, they're moving their eyes back and forth, following the movement of the therapist, either finger or a stick or whatever, so that you're essentially asking them to do something with their eyes, moving across their field of vision for periods of, you know, 30 seconds or maybe a minute, whilst they're holding in mind imagery of that trauma. But as I said, the mechanism of action is unclear, even though it works. We don't know exactly why. The author Shapiro sort of proposed that it mimicked REM sleep, but I don't think the sort of neurobiological evidence is kind of can really establish that as being the mechanism. But we do know that with trauma-focused CBT, so anything that's kind of looking at the thoughts and feelings around kind of traumatic experience and EMDR, they share two key components. That is, what you're actually doing is asking the person, you're exposing the person to the memory of the trauma, and then you're helping them to process the meaning of how they interpret that event. And so the current evidence suggests that these key components are the ingredients for effectiveness for the treatment. If you can go to the next slide. So what I want to show you now is something that is, because we've gone through lots of stuff, but I want to give you something to